running orders now. Anyone needs a running order?
Hello, I'm Paul Morley, and welcome to Chasing Celebrity, where I examine the myths and realities of modern celebrity, marvel at the length some people will go to achieve fame and then to hang on to it.
Dancing the Samba. Will Alicia Dixon and her dance partner Matthew Cutler please take to the floor?
And explore the industry that feeds it and is fed by it. Last week, I explained how the rise of fake plastic celebrity culture and our insatiable appetite for trashy celebrity gossip was directly connected to the increase in the relentless power of television and the scandalous desires of the tabloid press. This week, I look a little closer at the everyday business of fame, how this rampant celebrity culture is organised and how it maintains its financial and cultural momentum. Why do brand new celebrities turn up for duty just about every day, even as they see the way that the attention they crave can lead to ruthless invasion of privacy, and the love and admiration turn into brutal cultural envy? And why am I so fascinated by what the famous are like, and what it's like to be famous, even after years of experience knowing that they're just like the rest of us, but more desperate, and perhaps a little stranger, and ever anxious that any minute now it will all come to an end? And you never know, making this programme might even just be a way of raising my profile to ensure the call comes through from Strictly Come Dancing, the current golden celebrity programme, where a variety of celebrities appear to demonstrate that they're not in it for the fee, fame or attention, but to learn a new skill and impress the nation with their dedication and commitment. And just in case the show's celebrity bookers haven't yet noticed my own dedication and commitment, I make sure I get onto the set of the last series to mix with a few of the dedicated dancing celebrities.
My initial worries was that, you know, I hope they don't think I'm doing it to release a record and all that kind of stuff.
I didn't really class myself as being famous. I walked in the first day on Strictly and I thought they were going to ask me to make the tea.
I didn't actually realise how big it was, to be honest. I never actually realised it was on every night during the week. And I didn't realise you would get 9 million people watching it.
Reality TV fiercely maintains that all life is a ruthless competition that you have to win, even if you lie and cheat, else you fade into miserable obscurity. Reality shows and their celebrity versions encourage a kind of emotional and often physical bullying that even at its most vicious is horribly compelling. We watch people negotiate the glib terror and random stupidity of reality shows, intrigued by the journey that the victims are going on. And journey became the key 21st century TV word, because however unscripted these programmes may be, there are still engrossing stories to follow, filled with heroes, villains, losers, and eventually, winners.
Walking around the place, every third person, especially while the programme's on, wants to have a chat with you.
It's like being a normal person in Liverpool, where everyone talks to you anyway.
I can say honestly, I adore and love the celebrity that has come with my success and my work.
People who don't like me will say I'm a media tart. We both are, you know, they'll do anything. But I prefer to think of myself as a media butterfly, which just means I'm very versatile and I can flip from one thing to another.
If I'm in the supermarket and you want an autograph, come right up to me and I'll sign you an autograph. I'll take a picture with you on a camera phone. I have no problem. I'm absolutely loving the celebrity you've given me.
I don't think people seek to categorise us much now. We're just kind of there. We're part of the wallpaper. We've been around. We're a bit like the Simpsons, you know, the Hamiltons. And it's amazing how often we don't even get called by our proper name. We are just the Hamiltons.
Celebrity, the new religion, which is what it is today.
To me, fame equated being adored, being all of these things, and I wanted that. I never had it. I always felt that I hadn't achieved anything, and fame meant I'd achieved something in my life.
More people read about celebrities on a daily basis than go to church.
We're all promoting something.
You know, who fell over or who did Lily Allen punch this morning? You know, we love it.
It's definitely a job.
When you're in that celebrity life, you have to kind of really look at yourself before you go anywhere. I mean, I'm a confident person in what I do, but on that side of things, I didn't feel confident at all. And I think you have to be a certain type of person to want to be that celebrity.
Oh, we know the downside.
Don't want people looking through my rubbish. It happens.
Everyone seems to know everything about everyone. And news comes to the fore gossip certainly comes to the fore very, very quickly.
I once had to move house because I had some fans in my garden, like, making wolf noises at me.
Yes, I think it is important to stay in the limelight. Clearly, if nobody knows who we are or they've forgotten who we are, then there's a lot of work which we get which wouldn't continue to flow.
Managed well, you can earn a lot of money. And the flip side is that you're saying goodbye to any sort of privacy that you ever had.
They're the ones who've put you here, and you have to be responsive to that, and you also have to honour that. So I sign it. I have no problem with it.
Let's see how easy it is to become a celebrity in this new post-reality television world, where reality itself is being infected by the trivialising presence of celebrity power. Because there are more opportunities to get on television, does this mean fame is increasingly within the reach of everyday people? And if you do find fame just by walking through the door of a reality show and acting a bit mental or vulnerable, does this mean the glory, money and adoration you anticipated were a sacrifice of sanity and a loss of dignity? And as an audience, do we want to see celebrities succeed, or are we more interested, and hence always so enthralled, because we want to see them fail? And does our current obsession with celebrity activity reflect a widespread resistance to engage with anything serious? Or is it just a harmless escape from grey routine, a way of identifying with handsome, confident, if damaged people who get a chance to try things on our behalf?
We can get Geth in next. Alicia's quite happy for you to grab her when she's finished. And Kenny as well.
Why do apparently sensible people like singer and Mystique member Alicia Dixon, rugby player and husband of Gabby Kenny Logan, and Blue Peter presenter Gethin Jones want to participate in what is as such a celebrity show?
What I've come to realise by doing Blue Peter is I actually love the challenges I'm not very good at. And I put dancing at the top of my list of things that I can't do. And I found out about Strictly Come Dancing whilst building a shelter in a jungle in Bolivia. And I thought to myself at the time, well, it can't be as hard as this. And boy, am I eating my words now.
Mm. And were you a fan of the show previously? Have you watched it before?
Yeah, I'd watched pretty much every series since the very start. My sister is a massive fan. So I got her tickets to the semi-final 2 years ago. There was a real buzz there, and I just thought to myself, brave people, I'd never do that in a million years.
Mm. Well, I wanted to do the show originally because I wanted to learn how to dance. Right. So that was the main reason I wanted to do the show, and to get really fit. And I have actually loved every minute of it, even the stressful times, to be honest.
So, Kenny, yeah, it is just about the last thing you probably need when you're working so hard at the moment. Someone will come along and ask you questions about what it is you're doing, why you're doing it and how it's going. But on the other hand, by agreeing to do something like this, that's exactly what's going to happen, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you get asked to do loads of stuff, but it's been an amazing experience for me so far, you know, considering when I went first into it, I thought I'd last a week.
What in the end did make you do it? What did you think was going to happen? Did you think it was going to be, you know, a way of learning a new skill, or did you think, oh, hang on a minute, this is a great way of raising profile, of becoming someone?
Well, I never thought about profile, because at the end of this, I'd still want to do what I do. I didn't really think about it as being famous, because you're known anyway. You know, in the circles that I was known, I was happy with that. But, you know, when I go to rugby dinners now, I've spent most of the time talking about Strictly Come Dancing. And who knows what happened in the future with me. I'm just going to see what happens. I'm not desperate to get into television. If something was good, I would do it. But I'm not telling my agent, go and get me something, you know.
Have you seen a change in the level of recognition that there is for you?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the older generation that would never have bought or heard of a Mystique record suddenly are going, oh, it's Alicia from Strictly. And you're like, oh, right, now it's like a different age range of people. Obviously, the younger generation that was familiar with the band. Yeah, but definitely like sort of like my nan's generation, they obviously become more aware of you.
Do you find with the intense attention paid to you, certainly as well during the week, that sometimes you might be giving away too much about yourself?
Yeah, for example, if you're like tired and you want to have a little tear or cry and you think you want to do that in private and they won't allow you to, and then you start thinking, well, do I want to show this part of myself? But then at the same time you think, well, we're all human. And actually it's that thing of relating to people why I think it, again, is appealing, because we all like to relate to what people are going through.
But what I've done is just be myself. So I've not tried to be any different, I've just been me. And so then when I go out, it's me that people see. I don't really want to be somebody that I don't know.
Is it hard to be you under these circumstances? Does it become like a version of yourself, a self-conscious version, or can you still maintain just being natural?
No, I think I'm natural. I think there's no airs and graces about me. I'm what I am. You know, I just go out and have a good laugh and enjoy it. And then showing I've got a soft side to me. And the dancing probably has brought a lot more of that out in me, being a bit softer and getting my hands a bit smaller, which has been hard. But in general, I enjoy the challenge of it all, and I enjoy, you know, I suppose you're more recognised now, that's for sure, yeah. Especially by sort of women.
Is that a new kind of addiction to get used to? You think, I'm going to enjoy this, I want more of this.
I wouldn't say I want more of it, and, you know, I've enjoyed doing Strictly. I didn't do Strictly to become famous or to become more well-known. I did it because I wanted to do it.
I think the advantage for me is that being in a band, people are aware of your music, but they don't always get to see your character. And I think with a show like this, you can't hide behind anything. You know, you are who you are, and the show really shows that side off to you. And I'm just myself, and hopefully people like that. But I think that's the advantage, that people get to know your character.
Live from London, this is the Strictly Come Dancing Grand Final.
Sequins, dancing, what's that all about? You have a go at it. Mark Ramprakash, Matt Dawson, Kenny Logan, the manliest men you'll ever meet in your lives, and they're loving it. Kenny's out there with a big smile on his face doing a quick step. Do you know what I mean?
Will you carry on dancing?
Yeah, if Gabby's good enough.
They wouldn't want to admit it too explicitly because it breaks the innocent beauty of the show. But appearing on Strictly Come Dancing does enhance the nature of a contestant's fame. And if you do agree to participate, it may well be because you want to dance, but you'll also know very well that it will confirm your credentials as a celebrity. To appear on such a show, you will be driven, or others behind the scenes will be driving you, toward bigger dreams. And those that do well, who survive, even win, will enter a new celebrity realm, which, with careful direction, leads to better, more lucrative jobs, and more crucially, greater longevity in a world now crowded with others demanding our attention. And if you do well on this show, it means that you have, in front of a whole nation and the blessed Brucey, proved that you have a talent.
Fame was naturally a word that was linked to a concept, which was famous for something. Like, you were famous for being the first person to climb Mount Everest. You had a talent.
Raj Prasad, a consultant psychiatrist at the Bethlehem Royal and Maudsley Hospitals and Gresham Professor for Public Understanding of Psychiatry. He appears on TV and radio expressing considerable diagnostic knowledge of the peculiar laws ruling the celebrity universe, and that means he himself has become a kind of celebrity.
It doesn't seem to matter anymore what they're famous for. Just being a celebrity is good enough in this day and age. These are people who've crafted the art of how to get attention.
Is there a particular person that's good at that?
Actually, only very recently have psychologists tried to study that question scientifically. And of course, the problem is, to study celebrities from an academic psychological standpoint has always been problematic, because how do you get hold of them to put them on the couch? But there's recently been a fascinating academic paper where some psychologists used a chat show on which celebrities appeared, and they gave them a personality test. And one of the tests they used was called the NPI, or the Narcissism Personality Inventory, which measures how narcissistic you are. And lo and behold, on this chat show, it was found that the celebrities had a significantly higher score or narcissism than the general population. But even more interesting was that people who were famous for being on reality TV shows, these were the most narcissistic of all.
And have these people with this kind of narcissism, have they always been around, or is it now because there is more opportunities for them to display themselves, or is it a new kind of condition?
One would argue possibly that narcissism has probably always been around, but probably hasn't had the outlet that it's got today. That just because you thought you were wonderful wasn't good enough in the past, because you actually had to be good at something. And if you thought you were wonderful at playing the piano, but basically you weren't, you would fall at the first hurdle. But nowadays you don't fall at that hurdle. And if you are manipulative enough and work at it hard enough, you can get on TV if you believe you're deserving enough.
Every Why do people fundamentally want to go through a lot of the pressures, the rigours, the complications of becoming famous?
There's a sociological theory about that, which is that in this day and age where you walk onto a tube train in the middle of London and feel the indifference, we live in increasingly large cities where we are insignificant mm-hmm. and we are ignored by everyone. We're given a hard time. You're barged out the way. And becoming famous means a return to becoming significant. And it means a return back to an idyllic past, maybe 200-300 years ago, where we were born, lived and died in the same village. You only knew about 150 people who all knew you, and you had significance. People gave you respect. You were somebody in that village. And we've lost that. And maybe what people are craving for is a return to some kind of significance. A famous person walks onto an aeroplane and the crew give them special attention and look after them. And actually what's really happening is you're being treated like an ordinary human being, a decent human being. Mm-hmm. You're not being ignored the way everyone else is. And maybe that's what people are craving a return to, and that's why they want to pursue fame. It's a pursuit of significance, which we are all hungry for.
Perhaps fear of anonymity is what drives the non-skilled to become celebrities, and fear of disappearing forever into endless nowhere, while all around them television shows a world where they can stand out, apparently just by being themselves. To the outsider looking in at the celebrity party, the thought of becoming well-known obviously means fame and fortune, but also a way of belonging, of going from being no one to being someone. Loved and adored by millions, instead of just being one of the faceless millions doing the loving. Perhaps you also figure it's entirely natural that everyone else will love the sound of your own voice as much as you do. Perhaps you think you actually do have a talent. And these days, the only way you can get noticed is by first becoming a celebrity.
I wouldn't recommend anybody wakes up in the morning and says, Yahoo, I want to be a celebrity, because I just don't think that in itself is worth pursuing.
I wanted to work as a musician. I wanted to be a jobbing musician, whether it was as a session musician or in an orchestra, in any capacity possible.
For me, what really counts is getting things done, whether that's in Parliament or in my life. And the fame bit is a waste product.
Madonna, I grew up on Madonna.
A reproduction, a D-list, a reality show, a makeover, a mockery of celebrities. The ex-MP Neil Hamilton with his wife Christine, and the current MP Lembit Opik, who in an act of prime celebrity oddness now partners cheeky girl Gabriella Iremia. Musician and TV and radio presenter Mylene Klass, and resident of Big Brother 2, Narinder Kaur.
I wanted to be Madonna, and I remember watching Madonna's interviews, and she was always like, I wanted to be famous, I wanted people to love me, I want everyone to know me. And I always remember thinking, my God, she did it, she's done it. And she took so much criticism, she sang like Minnie Mouse, but she achieved it. And I thought, why can't I? And as a young girl, teenager, growing up in the Northeast, you read the magazines, you see it on the telly, we were fed, be famous and your life will mean something.
I never set out to be a celebrity, but it sort of happened as a result of having a famous relationship and sometimes doing things which individuals regard as wacky or newsworthy. So I've ended up being well-known because of the things I've done. I haven't done those things to get well-known.
We're not just celebrities. It's true we are well-known, but that just contrasts with my former life when I was an anonymous member of the government running the country in my spare time. Now I do silly things on television and everybody knows who I am and what I look like. But we've got a hinterland and we can do things and do things. It's not just that we are Neil and Christine Hamilton and we just are there to be looked at. We have to do something as well to keep the public interest in ourselves as performers.
Nowadays, it's almost a byproduct of what you do. It's integral to you being able to either A, release a record or an album or get publicity for a tour that's coming up. It's a real symbiotic relationship.
When we first sort of launched into this freewheeling, freelancing lifestyle as a result of leaving politics, not of our own volition, if you had asked us then, 10 years ago, will you have made a success of this extraordinary unfolding world, I don't think we would have predicted how successful we've been. And, you know, we have. Our detractors may hate it, but we have been successful.
So how did the Hamiltons achieve their eccentric success? Well, what tipped the Hamiltons from the show business of politics to the show business of show business happened in the 1997 general election, when a Cash for Questions row led Hamilton to lose his Tatton seat to ex-BBC journalist Martin Bell, who stood as an anti-corruption candidate.
Well, we were embroiled in the 97 election, and I had a standoff with Neil's independent opponent.
Do you accept that a man is innocent unless proved guilty?
Yes, of course I do.
So you accept that my husband is innocent?
I think there's a lot of...
Do you accept that my husband is innocent?
I'm not facing an ambush here. Let's just see what comes out. I don't know.
And the whole of the press came down on my head. I was the wife from hell, the monstrous liability, the bossy termagant, etc., etc.
You can sometimes believe what you read in the tabloid press, you see.
Have I got news for you? Noticed this and thought, gosh, she'd be quite fun on the programme. I declined to go on the programme during the election because I frankly didn't have time. And then after the election was over and Neil had then been defeated, they invited us both to go on. And, hey, we were unemployed and we thought, why not? And opinions divided. Some people thought that we were very stupid to go on and others thought, and we agreed with these people, needless to say, that we held our own.
Proof now on BBC Two that some people will do anything to get on telly.
And we knew why we were there. We knew we were there to be the butt of their jokes.
I mean, it is a paradox that when I lost my seat in 1997, I was demonised by the tabloids. And I was fundamentally unemployable in any conventional walk of life because nobody would have wanted that sort of publicity walking into their businesses. They don't want to be bothered with unwanted headlines in national newspapers or paparazzi outside the front door. So we had to climb a huge mountain to create a successful new life for us, and it didn't come about as a result of some preordained planning. It's been a painstaking, slow, zigzag process, but I think we've now surmounted all those initial difficulties and have become transformed. Well, I hardly say from frog to handsome prince, but you get the impression.
Are you familiar with Mr. Zappa's work?
No, I'm not at all familiar with that whole story. I mean, we haven't read the papers this week, so I didn't know what that was all about. Right.
Did you not know you were coming on this programme?
Have you actually heard the election results?
The Hamiltons' desperate need to defend themselves when no one would believe them perversely made them good, annoying telly, and they developed a hunger for publicity and the attention that made them feel less reviled, and also an insight into how they could turn their downfall into necessary income. By selling themselves as themselves, working hard to turn their dotty double act, a combination of thick skin, distracted poshness and brazen opportunism, into a kind of modern celebrity brand. The stubborn, awkward personality traits that led to their downfall in politics made commercial sense in the sick celebrity world of reality TV. People even wanted to watch their journey.
Some people do feed on the adulation, and it's what keeps them going, and shut the door and they're on their own at home and it's, oh my goodness, what do I do next? We need the celebrity side because that's how we earn a living. We do television, radio, act. Neil has a regular newspaper column in a Sunday newspaper, that sort of thing. And that's what we do for a living. It's how we keep body and soul together. So we need it to that extent.
It is a job, but it's very easy to go out and be photographed. A lot of girls know the secret to that to a degree, as do the guys. But it's the staying power as well, and it's what you want to be recognised for.
You're listening to Chasing Celebrity with me, Paul Morley. And I'm not just bravely venturing deep into the tangled jungle of modern celebrity, but also getting some tips from those in the know about how to enter the ranks of the famous, or at least the temporarily well-known to those who read every word in Heat magazine.
Hello, my name is Christian Leontiou, and I'm in a band called One Eskimo.
We're in the Cobden Club in West London for a concert showcase by a group who hope to be a big new thing this year. They've already had a session on the Janice Long Show here on trend-setting Radio 2, but there's much more planned. As their managers James O'Driscoll and Rudy Reed explain, there has to be.
Do you want to go?
You go.
All right. I mean, One Eskimo is a project, it's an outfit, it's a band, it's a beautiful record with 12 tracks on it. And it's a creative expression.
I think maybe in the past you could have taken a good record and been able to put it out to a marketplace, and that would be enough. And now that's not the case.
Okay, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to 4/6 Live here at the Cobham Club. Appreciate that it's very, very cold outside. But believe me, you are here for all the right reasons, because the music we have for you tonight is absolutely fantastic. Will you please put your hands together and welcome to the stage, the brilliant One Eskimo.
I want to sing, and I want to make music, and I want to be recognised doing that, and I want people to hear what I'm doing, but the celebrity thing kind of comes with it. And I'm trying to make it less about me and trying to make it just more about what the project and what my music's about.
This is the story of an average sort of fellow who lives in a nice average neighbourhood in a nice average town. Every night he comes home to his nice average house. And in due time, he goes to sleep.
We help it. We aid it.
Assist it.
Assist it. We assist it.
You, you're my queen, longer than you know. My love for you helps me every step I take, every day I live, everything I see. And if I...
Is it more difficult to do it now rather than in the 60s? I think... Back then, I understand that if you get the support and if you're put on telly, then you kind of made it, because very few people did get through. You know, now we've got so many people competing, so I don't know. I don't know if it is more difficult. I think we've got online stuff now, so it's easier to get your stuff out there. But because there's so much stuff out there, then, you're kind of... It's a numbers game, really. People get signed, people get dropped, people get a lot of money spent on them, and you'll never hear of them, you know? Whereas then, I think if you got through, then you made a career out of it.
Why?
From a management standpoint, if you have a successful artist, you want your artist to be in the paper. You want your artist to be on the radio. We always work on a premise that a member of the public will have maybe 3 or 4 opportunities to see that artist or hear that artist before they go and buy a record. Is that the point they become celebrity? Is it at that point where there's a familiarity and someone can hear and see someone? I don't know if that's celebrity. If that's the case, then yes, we do want celebrity. Because we want people to have some sort of ownership of the material. We want them to feel that it's something that they want to own. The marketplace is wider. 4 million guitars sold last year. Something ridiculous. Everyone wants to be in a band. And a lot of people can do it very quickly. But that doesn't give you sustainability in a career. If you know the right people, it's probably quite easy to make a record. But it's like the building we're in at the moment. If you walk into Radio 2, 500 singles, something like that, 500 singles a week get put forward for playlists, and maybe 5 spots. So that's 1 in 100 chance. So it's a very, very small window of opportunity, and there's a lot of people fighting for those spaces.
Has everyone been through this?
What, read it all?
Yeah.
Oh, we'll be here all night if I read it all.
Well,
Well, I think at the moment we're talking to about 8 or 9 labels.
All new successes in the entertainment world are planned over many months at many meetings that work out just how to break a particular act. Even for the most allegedly hip act, a whole team of creative and technical experts will plot the way forward. One Eskimo are not signed to a label, but already have management, radio promotion, press publicity, internet marketing, a live booking agent, all of them working out how to make it seem the most natural thing in the world that you are suddenly aware of One Eskimo. Even this very mention here by me in this context is part of the plan to make you aware that they exist.
Fly. We'll get reaction, but it's how hard we kind of push for it. And, you know, I don't want to kind of push too hard at the moment.
You want to know if we're ready for your first spot to catch.
Yeah, it's like things really before. We can go blazing, but we don't want to peak too early when, A, you know, nothing's in place. Because then we just kind of will burn out.
There's no accidents in a successful artist. I mean, whoever the team are behind it, it's a business and it's a team. Hopefully, as a team, you've got the same goal. To give your artist the one thing they want, which is success. Now, from our point of view, success doesn't necessarily equate to celebrity.
The last week in March, when we do have availability, I know it's miles away, but the single release date for Candy, I've already got a date penciled in as a launch event at the Soho Review Bar, and that's being held for me just now.
For us, it's a 9-month, 12-month campaign to sort of help Christian get to a particular point where we can utilise media, we can utilise radio and press to get it out to a wider audience, and in turn, they'll vote whether they like it or not. And as a manager and as an artist, it's hugely important that you carve out a long-term career. Being on a magazine is great for your ego, but if it doesn't sustain a career, you're not around in 12 months' time.
Some sort of clip, viral clip. Potentially, depending on when we get it, it could be quite nice to tie into Valentine's Day, the whole he called me baby, that kind of thing.
See, there's one picture.
Usually, it does seem like everything's a payoff for something else. It does feel like this is done for that reason. But it is a game, I suppose, but I'm not willing to kind of play it like that. I'm not willing to do that. And even with this interview that we're having, the reason I'm doing it is because I want people to kind of see what it's like and the differences between the different ways of doing it. I think people kind of feel you put your tracks on MySpace now, and if it's good, it'll come through and you have a career in music, whereas that is not the truth at all. It's a hard slog, and it's relentless. You do want to get the profile, I suppose, is the main thing that you do want to get out there. I want to get the name out there. I want people to recognise it. I want people to see it. It's a payoff, one thing for the next thing.
In this fragmented, multi-channel, internet-led world, One Eskimo may not need an official record label to help them succeed, just hired people who can help them get attention. And in this fluid, post-ironic world, filled with numerous previous examples of celebrity success, you don't necessarily need old-fashioned talent to become famous.
It's fantastically democratised now. And people see it as a career. Polls in schools show people see being a celebrity, being famous, not for anything in particular, as a career.
People are much more aware of how the game is played.
PR maestro James Herring and leading brandologist Peter York.
Everyone who's seen it as a career in that free-form way, it's like tracking the careers of serial killers. You look at where they've been reading Heat and Closer when they're 8, underlining things. So they've been reading it most assiduously. Like those girls who got their secondary education out of Cosmopolitan in an earlier age.
Heat readers know how to play the game of Big Brother. They know about newspaper buy-ups, they know about deals, they know about words like copy approval.
They're reading between the lines. They're thinking, that was clever, that rehab was clever. I mean, the simple thing is that stories about celebrities are surprised by celebrities themselves.
And they know about, you know, people doing deals with paparazzi photographers, of which they profit from. You know, citizen journalism and blogs and the rise of the camera phone and home video recording equipment has changed the way that people run their own media now. the YouTubes and the holy molies of this world are as much a part of the celebrity media creation factory as, you know, the Sun and Heat magazine are.
You can make it so far with a certain amount of wit and media understanding, but can you survive and thrive once you've grabbed some attention without the traditional support and guidance of a team of agents, managers, stylists and publicists?
Yeah, I don't think you can go and set out to achieve all of this on your own without having some decent help. I think that a lot of people that have tried that have got their fingers quite badly burnt.
There are a lot of people who will claim that they can do this, that or the other. Most of those are charlatans.
Can the new celebrity, fresh out of Big Brother, exist without the sophisticated likes of Agent John Holmes?
To be honest, I don't think you should consider getting an advisor till you've moved on a bit, till people start wanting to pay you serious money.
Publicist Max Clifford.
You need someone on your side that is going to tell you as it is, that knows how to make it work, basically.
Manager John Thodey.
Our business is about people who I see as having long-term successful careers. Part of that is being a celebrity or becoming a star. My job is to get them there and keep them there.
And PR consultant Alan Edwards.
To me, I'm like a surgeon. I have to look at an issue and decide how to best operate, what the best moves are going to be. I have to come at it very technically, not very intellectually or emotionally or otherwise.
There are advisors who claim, well, he came to me and he was nothing and then I made him into something. I don't actually believe that. I think in life everyone has one of two destinations. They're either going to make a million or they're going to go bust. Most people are quite fortunate they die before they go bust. And all you do as an advisor is speed up or slow down the process. If someone's going to go bust, I've acted for people who you know, whatever you do, they're going to lose it all. And all you can do is stop them losing it quite as quickly as they set out in the first place. They're not good people to advise, incidentally, and on the whole, I try to avoid them. On the other hand, there are people who you know are going to be immensely successful and immensely wealthy, and all you can do is say, well, that would be a better way of going about it, and they get there quicker.
The game of celebrity, the game of publicity, is an absolute part of being a star. I don't believe you can do it without it.
You need someone who can help you to make the best of yourself, to promote you and to protect you, to open the doors, but the right doors, and keep the wrong doors shut.
Ultimately, what I really strongly believe, it's quite a good idea to be seen everywhere. You can't be successful if people don't come and see your shows or watch your TV shows. So if you do something that is good, it's quite a good idea that everybody knows about it. If you're someone who is writing a play, writing a film, starring in a film, you know, if you're a creative, somebody who creates a TV show, then by far the most important thing is the thing you're creating. Everything else drives whether an audience comes to it. Driving whether an audience comes to something and whether it comes to a celebrity now is becoming more and more important every day, because ultimately you can't just make one appearance on the Royal Variety Show to become successful. You've got to do something good quite a lot and people need to know about it.
I mean, the first thing I'd do is assess the strengths and weaknesses. Are they articulate? Can they really carry this on? Are they going to look great in photographs? Or are we really trying to camouflage a lot of things? And then we'll go down the less is more route and less access, because they've really not got anything very interesting to say. And we'll dress it up and create a myth of, well, you know, they're not available because this, that and the other. It's a bit like a car MOT. You go through that whole process first. Then when you've analysed what you've genuinely got, you decide how you're going to present that, how you're going to polish it up. So there's a whole process to be gone through if you're going to do it properly before you even start. And the hardest work is working out what you've really got. Is there a longer term future? What are their aspirations? Do they want to be presenting a TV show in a few years, or do they have absolutely no future plan whatsoever? You really got to go through all of that before you even hit the road. Otherwise you'll end up the road going nowhere and you'll wander off.
Do you kind of audition the would-be celebrity and check that out? Do you go through a scientific process of working out what kind of stamina they have, what they're after?
Yeah, I do. I don't know how scientific it is. It's definitely programmed in my head to make that immediate assessment. I mean, I might even draw those conclusions in one phone call, possibly, or certainly in one meeting, because you know how someone can handle themselves in 20 or 30 minutes is probably going to be how they're going to handle themselves on GMTV or in The Sun or whatever going forward. So first reactions are usually pretty good, actually. First instincts are good.
Publicists have been around as long as there's been any kind of show business. It may well be the second oldest profession. Max Clifford and Alan Edwards have been running publicity campaigns for stars and celebrities for decades, looking after the image and interests of clients, some of whom are so famous the task is to keep them out of the papers. They like to think of themselves as being above the cheap sub-tabloid celebrity carnage, distancing themselves from the celebrity-obsessed world, even as they skillfully direct and exploit its wild, unfocused, but very useful energy.
Most of the people that come to me want protection, not promotion, it's protection. It used to be. In the 60s and the 70s, it was all about promotion. Mm. Every year in the last 20 years, it's more about protection than promotion. You know, for every story I break now, even when it's on my clients or whatever, there's 20 I stop.
When I was doing publicity in the early days, if you were doing a rock group or something like that, people weren't that interested in the private lives of rock stars. When I'd call up the Daily Telegraph and it would be a guy called John Coldstream, I'd call him about the Stranglers. And the Stranglers would have just smashed up, God knows how many dressing rooms, been arrested and done everything else, you know. And John would say, you know, what was the guitar solo like? Well, you know, this is going to go in the critics page and I'm putting it alongside the opera piece. And we need to know, did he play for a 3-minute solo? Was that a 4-minute solo? And was he using a Gretsch or was he using a... And they treated it as art. And most of the national papers were the same. And they weren't really interested in the rest of the antics. That has changed now. If you've got a sensational story, it's got Britney's story, it's going to end up the front cover of the Telegraph just as much as it is anywhere else.
Perhaps those most to blame for the modern celebrity freak show are those that gossip the most. The voracious, dirt-dishing journalists that daily supply our fix, ensuring we don't lose the taste for it in various celebrity-saturated papers and magazines. Like Eva Simpson, one of the original 3am girls in the Mirror, and now assistant editor of the free tabloid of the London paper. And first of all, Michelle Davis, assistant editor of Grazia, who paid her dues at pioneering postmodern scandal sheet Heat magazine.
Putting someone like Jade Goody or Britney on your cover, it has to be the moment of their lives when it's a complete car crash. You know, that's when you can see a sales spike.
I mean, celebrities on the front pages put sales on for newspapers. It's not rocket science, it's the fact, you know, readers want to read about famous people, their lives. They especially like to read it when their lives are going wrong, the wheels have come off, when, you know, bad things happen to celebrities, people lap that up.
Sometimes you have to stop and remind yourself that these are human beings with feelings and emotions, and, you know, because they're like cartoon characters sometimes. You're watching Britney shave her head, attack photographers with an umbrella, and it feels like you're watching a film. It doesn't feel that there's any sort of sense of reality about it, and it's not necessarily about Britney as a person, it's just watching this sort of car crash element of her life. That's what people find fascinating.
No matter how rich and famous people are, they can still have problems that money can't solve. Their marriages break up, their wives or husbands cheat or leave them. And so the bigger the celeb, the bigger the drama, then hopefully the bigger the sales for us.
The sort of lower end of the market, sort of Heat, Closer, Reveal, that is hugely competitive. There are so many magazines out there. I mean, you know, when we started, first came out with Heat, there was sort of like, OK, Hello, and now there's all these sort of like copycat titles. It's become a huge, huge market, and it is extremely competitive. It's why someone can go into Big Brother, spend 10 weeks in a house in Hertfordshire, and everyone wants to talk to them. You've only got to see sort of, with the last Big Brother, Ziggy and Chanel, it was like one week he says on one cover and one week she says on one cover, and it just went on for weeks, and you just think, God, they're absolutely coining it.
Those in the business obviously like to hype how much money can be made, That's the way it works. But publicist James Herring and Big Brother's Narinder Kaur have their own, more realistic figures.
I think, interestingly enough, most people assume that the television programme is going to be the high-paying thing. But it isn't, actually. It's the magazine and the newspaper deals and the other endorsements and the things that come out of the back of it that is where it gets lucrative. I mean, I think that the fees for appearing on reality TV shows are pretty conservative, really. At the bottom end, £1,000 for 8 weeks' work. At the top end, sort of 20, 30 grand. There may be prize money for the winner, which is well above that, but the actual fees for participating are pretty low. But if you win one of these competitions and you come out of it well and you're somebody that newspapers and magazines regard as being someone who will sell copies, then you could be tripling your money overnight on a decent magazine and newspaper deal.
I remember reading stories that Nasty Nick has made, you know, $500,000, and Craig's made $1 million, and Melanie Hill's travelling around the world. So I thought, I can get that. Oh, my God, I can get that. You don't think you'll be the failure. You don't think you'll be the reject. You think, I've got a chance making a name for myself and also making some money.
Magazine deals vary enormously, but, you know, for a decent set of snaps with you and your family at home, you know, you could command £25,000 for a day's work, which is pretty good, I think. You've obviously got to be prepared to show off your property, which some people are paranoid about as being a calling card to all the local burglars. You've got to be prepared to put your children sometimes and your other family into the pictures as well, which is, again, comes with another set of problems. If you choose to have your family photographed in one of these magazines, then it's pretty unlikely that you would be able to. If you were going to court on an invasion of privacy claim with another newspaper, that wouldn't be a credible case, would it? Because you've already paraded them in a magazine. So there's a residual price attached to doing these things.
But when I came out of the house, I remember I was never bothered about being evicted because I thought, yeah, now I can do my fame thing, do my TV, do my radio, get my own show, get a part in EastEnders. Why wouldn't a Bollywood producer knock at my door? Why wouldn't I get a bikini deal with Marks and Spencers? Why wouldn't I? 10 million people have just watched me and 5 million people have just voted me out. That's more than the general elections. So why wouldn't I get that? You've got to see where my delusion came from. I remember coming out the house and thinking, OK, I'm out week 5, week 4, I'm not too bothered as long as I make a little bit of money now. And I sat down with outside and I remember they said, OK, X Sunday newspapers offered you this amount. And it was something like, I think, £15,000. Now, I earned more as a medical rep. And I remember thinking, you know, I haven't heard that right. 50,000. And they went, no, 15. And I was like, no, you've got to be having a laugh. And that was what I was offered. That was it. And I was earning more as a rep. And I thought, oh, my God. And I remember everything just feeling like it was crashing and thinking, it can't be 15 grand. I have not given up my entire life. I have a mortgage. I have a marriage. I've put kids on hold. And I remember thinking, no, he said 50. Please, God, let him have said £50,000. That's all I got. They said it went to bidding, and I thought, and that's all it got to. If it went to bidding, why are you bidding? My mum?
If you're sleeping with a married politician or an England football hero, then, you know, £200,000. If you've been involved in a punch-up in some celebrity bar and you were the third person to come out of a 16-person reality TV contest, then it's going to be a few hundred quid.
So when they say money, you make money. No, you will only make money if you win, or if there is something that you've done in the house that is notorious, then you will make money. Then you are looking at six figures. But I didn't. I just, you know, I was just a little bit of a moody cow. Of course I wasn't going to make any money.
Those that chase celebrity across an artificial landscape of reality shows, gossip pages, daytime television, TV commercials, websites and glitzy nightclubs do so because they need to find a basic way to show off that they exist, that they're alive, that they're worth knowing and noticing. For others, it's a mere career, a practical way of earning money in an unstable world dominated by entertainment. They're prepared for the hard work, the tabloid intrusion, understanding that it's not about the glamour and the glory, but grinding out an income. But why are we, the audience, readers, consumers, so besotted by the celebrity and the incessant coverage of their frantic, messy lives? To the extent that our non-stop interest actually creates the environment inside which the celebrity operates. What are we getting from the relationship?
Again, there's been some interesting research looking at what kind of person is it that seems to get very obsessive about celebrities, devotes their life to reading celebrity magazines. And one interesting theory that some people have come up with is that these are people who often seem to have what are described by psychologists as slightly vaguer boundaries over their identity. In other words, what seems to be happening is often they're looking for a celebrity to make up their own identity. They're wanting to be like someone. They want to be like Jennifer Aniston or be more like her. And therefore they're using her as a guidance of how to be in life. And what's really fascinating about that is a theory that celebrity culture today has become the new religion. Mm. Because in the past, you looked to religion as a guide to how to live your life. Today, you look to Jennifer Aniston.
It also seems to be worrying that the nature of our heroes seem to be diminishing. Because I remember a time not long ago when someone like Christopher Biggins was derided as a failure in a way, a low-level celebrity without many redeeming factors that we kind of giggled at. Somehow there's been an extraordinary period of reality television that's led to the reintroduction of characters like that as genuine national treasures. Now, although on one hand that's very entertaining and quite attractive for a moment, the implications of that seem to be that we really are, because of, as a result of these kind of programmes, losing our touch with values and the idea of quality and authenticity.
I think that's a very important point. Let's go back to what happens if someone plays the piano brilliantly and you watch this. You might feel a little bit inadequate and insecure about the way you've spent your life because you can't play the piano brilliantly and this man's been on television doing this, or this woman has. And of course, what's reassuring about people who've led the life that you've led and aren't very good at running or aren't very good at anything but have still become famous is an implicit reassurance that you haven't wasted your life and your life's okay. Mm. So one of the problems is, do we want to live in a culture we want people to aspire to being better than they are? But at the same time, in doing that, naturally, you make people a bit unhappy about the way they are now. And we know that through history, many governments have been very invested in the idea of making people happy as they are. Because if they're happy as they are, they'll be complacent and they won't rebel or they won't be open to subversive ideas. Mm. The idea that things could be better than they are, but you may have to put a bit of effort in to being better than you are, is quite a dangerous idea.
Mm. I mean, I sometimes think I'm just being Philip K. Dick paranoid in noticing a trend that's happening later, that we appear to be softened up, almost beautifully symbolised by the giggling Biggins, softened up for something that's coming down the line, reducing our expectations, reducing the characters we aspire to, reduce our power, reduce our options, reduce our potential to be subversive, to try change, to move forward.
Well, you're sounding a little bit paranoid.
Thanks.
If I might say
you,
so.
You would know.
and that's going down the idea that there's a grand conspiracy theory. I, as someone who works in the National Health Service, subscribe more to the cock-up theory of the world, which is stuff happens.
You're right.
Because accidents happen and mistakes happen. And I, more along the idea, personally, that one of the reasons why celebrity culture has grown up is simply because of the growth of different media opportunities. Mm-hmm. Because by definition, if the media becomes much more accessible and anyone can start their own TV channel, then it's about how to shout for attention. And of course, what grabs your attention for the first few moments or first few seconds becomes what people become very good at. It becomes the culture of shock. Mm. And that's why art has become about shock. Mm. And how you get your book into the top 10 is by shocking.
Products and charities mean more to us if a celebrity sells them, as if they have secret knowledge we have no access to. Magazines sell more if they put a celebrity on the cover and promise we will learn something intimate about their lives, even if this often means merely finding out that they've lost their keys or have new ears. The illusion is created that celebrities, however obscure or unlikely, are special. Perhaps being paranoid for a moment, it all makes the world increasingly superficial, emphasises our cultural passivity and makes us easier, softer targets for the greedy commercial world. Or perhaps we willingly fall for the illusion because major and minor celebrities, for all their desperate desire to please, make the world a better, more enjoyable, even less frightening place, especially when they get four tens from the Strictly Come Dancing judging panel. This has been Chasing Celebrity, produced by Paul Kolbrak and written and presented by me, Paul Morley, a little bit more famous because of it, hoping that might mean a call from Celebrity MasterChef, if not Strictly Come Dancing.
I don't feel guilty about it. I think that what the public wants, the public gets.
I think that in any society, people have got their own gods, their own heroes, And, you know, every generation needs to create their own. And, you know, the younger sister needs somebody different from older sister. It's always been like that. It just gets bigger and bigger all the time because there's more and more people being thrown in front of you.
If people weren't enjoying these kind of programmes, they wouldn't watch them, and the channels would stop putting them on because none of their advertisers would pay for spots in the middle of them. I think it's very democratic. If they failed and people lost interest in them, they wouldn't be on the air anymore. Unlike in politics, where you have to wait 5 years before somebody disappears, on television, have a couple of dodgy episodes over a fortnight period and the commissioning editor will pull the plug on the next series. So it's quite democratic from that point of view.
If in those days when I started out, one person in a million was famous, now it's one person in 100,000 is famous, or I don't know.
So it's not as special?
Of course it's not. It's a game, it's a media game that gets ever more empty and meaningless every year.
And where will it end then?
Well, I suppose it will end where everybody's famous. Everybody has their own TV show, everybody has their own, and they all sit and watch their own TV show.
Considered a unirind from people there, and I said, "Yeah, I am," because I thought, "Oh, I might as well enjoy getting a little bit of love today." And then they went, "No, you're not. Unirind from Big Brother was much prettier, and she had bigger tits, you lying cow." And they walked away. I thought, "I can't win," and that is the moral to the story: you can't win.